You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Thanks for listening to us. As the election approaches, Americans will be sucked into the vortex intentionally created by the 24-hour news cycle, social media's algorithms, and a barrage of foreign influence campaigns mostly designed to make us fight each other and think less of our country. National security lawyers will be an important buffer against misunderstanding and division. So on this podcast, we want to give our listeners the news that will have long-term impact on our national security and not just favor one or another discussion about the election. And we want to elevate the dialogue so that we expect a higher standard this campaign season and every campaign season. Now, for those of you who are interested in the erosion of the U.S. currency and centralized systems of payment, such as SWIFT, and many of you, I'm sure, have watched with alarm as virtual currency has expanded and wondered whether it could create a long-term threat to the efficacy of U.S. sanctions and international sanctions regimes by displacing the dollar as the standard currency favored for international trade. Well, there is now another possible threat, and it's something we should think about as national security lawyers. So first, let me set forth a baseline. Some of you may have heard reference during the various podcasts by Brian Egan to something called SWIFT. SWIFT is the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. It is a system that powers most international money and security transfers, and it's a vast messaging network that is used by financial institutions so they can quickly, securely send and receive information such as money transfer instructions. Now, in an article, which I think was in Investopedia, they discussed that it is a member-operated cooperative and how, you know, safe and secure these transactions tend to be, and how it allows individuals and businesses to take electronic or card payments even if the customer or vendor uses a different bank from the payee, which is mostly the case, quite frankly. And the way it works, SWIFT works, is by assigning each member's institution a unique ID code, or a BIC, that identifies the bank name, country, city, and branch. Now, SWIFT members participate in and observe sanctions. And in this case, you might remember that they have observed sanctions on Iran, Russia, and Belarus, for example. Now, what we're faced with right now is that Russia's richest woman, she's working with Putin to help undermine SWIFT. So let's talk about this for just a minute, because this is not going to make the regular news, and it's stuff you have to find and dig out as a national security lawyer. So Tatiana Balalchuk, whom I think is either Siberian or she could even be Mongolian, I forget, but she is the founder and operator of a marketplace known as Wildberries. This is sort of Russia's answer, if you will, to Amazon. She is now determined to help Putin by setting up an alternative messaging system to counter SWIFT. That way, if transactions occurred over this alternative network, and that network was open to any transaction, whether illicit or not, whether in violations of sanctions or not, it could still go through. So this system will be created in partnership with, wait for it, Russia's largest investment group, also known as the Ross Group. And Putin, who keeps his friends closer and his enemies deader, has allegedly personally approved this venture and has chosen Maxim Oreshkin, who is his deputy head of the Kremlin's administration. And he's going to supervise this SWIFT replacing venture. And just so you know, Wildberries, Balalchuk's company, is, as I mentioned, Russia's answer to Amazon. Now, if you were to go on it, and I recommend you not do this, but you would see a lot of items that you know are no longer available to the Russian market, such as IKEA, for example, which has pulled out of Russia for obvious reasons. Sweden has now joined NATO, and they're none too impressed with what has happened in the Ukraine war. So I would ask you this, what laws and constitutional authorities could be used to counter this effort? And what structure might diplomacy take to counter this, or any international agreement? And how would those agreements be enforced? These are the questions you should be asking yourself as a national security lawyer. And in addition, you have to think forward, not just to the way the world looks immediately, but you're also sometimes in the business of predicting trends, just like somebody running a hedge fund would be. Now, returning to the importance of computer chips, we've done multiple podcasts on the CHIPS Act, the importance of computer chips, and how dependent we are on them for our advanced weapon systems, our overall defense, and of course, our day-to-day lives. A large percentage of our most sophisticated chips are made in the country of Taiwan, a country that China seeks to have rejoin the PRC. Well, last week, Chinese officials claimed that the United States, in terms of our politicians and our military leaders, that we were trying to goad China into invading Taiwan. An interesting claim. If that happened, I guess the question is the U.S. really ready to make all of its own chips? Understanding, as we have shown you through this podcast, by calling people from Intel and from the chip industry and from the White House who are policymakers on this, we are not ready, despite the CHIPS Act. It takes some years to bring these fabs online, and perhaps longer the more sophisticated the chip is. And if China did invade Taiwan, what would happen to the fabs in Taiwan on which we have grown way too dependent? Well, two of the biggest manufacturers, AML Holdings NV and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturer Company, which is like TSMC or however they abbreviate it, they have claimed that they have ways to disable their most sophisticated chip-making machines in the event of an attack. At least that's what's on Bloomberg right now. Now, would this be enough? And how can laws and regulations for imported semiconductors or chips be structured to prevent the immediate acquisition of extreme ultraviolet machines, or EUVs, for which TSMC is the largest client, given that these chips are used in the most sensitive military applications? And did the CHIPS Act address this? How would you solve this problem as a national security lawyer? It has a lot of layers and it's international in scope, but these are the problems that you need to think about. Now, as we're heading into election season, you're going to have to keep a level head, and this is going to be important during massive political changes. So what is China going to do to us during this process? Or do they have bigger long-term plans? Well, apparently they do, according to numerous sources. And their plan is to wage something known as cognitive warfare by setting up a new force within the PLA, which is the People's Liberation Army. Yes, I know it's ironically named since no one will be liberated by the PLA. And this force will focus exclusively on cognitive warfare. And it will seek to have an impact on human consciousness and thoughts such that people's perceptions of China not only change, but their own perception of their country is dulled and diminished. And what they intend to do is push out propaganda that literally distorts our view of our own country, our cohesion, and our views of China. Their goal, as stated, is to create social confusion by disseminating misinformation, committing cyber attacks, and reducing overall our motivation to fight, should that be necessary, and to, in particular, reduce political leaders' judgments. I'm not sure they need to be pushed, but the point is that this is part of a grand strategy on the part of China. And apparently some of that was memorialized in a PLA Daily piece that dates back to October of 2022, but has only recently gained any attention from the mainstream media, but certainly defense publications. And now the PLA will be assisted in these cognitive warfare efforts by developments in technology such as AI and, horrifyingly, brain-machine interface technology, or BMI, the stuff that I discussed with Sunita Patel in our podcast on science fiction as a cautionary tale. Now, Puma Shen of the Jamestown Foundation and other writers at the Jamestown Foundations have written pieces. Among these pieces, they describe how TikTok will be leveraged to dull our judgment, something that was predicted by non-scientist and marketing expert and investor Scott Galloway. Apparently, this strategy is being tested right now in China, by China, in Taiwan, and in Vietnam. Now, in Taiwan, it backfired, as you know, because China's most favorite candidate there did not win. But they're going all guns on Vietnam, and that does appear to get some traction if you've been paying attention to politics in Vietnam. More about that in the future. So what can policymakers do to counter this effort? And what can lawyers do? If China is going to constantly improve its hacking efforts and its efforts at cognitive warfare, how does the consolidation of services like those offered by Microsoft, from Teams to its suite of services that is so heavily used by the USG, how might the use of this complete suite of services make us more vulnerable? And how do the bigs, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon, vet their employees and engineers to ensure that they do not present a threat to our national security or have links to our enemies? What law exists to address this threat? And how can we solve this while keeping the integrity of our markets and our constitutional liberties? These are questions that young lawyers need to think about. You need to project our overall system, the way our markets and capitalism have developed, our constitutional authorities, and how some of these problems are going to have to be solved. So I'm sure a lot of you have heard the debates, and we're only going to focus because we do not take political sides at NSLT. We're not in that business, but we're going to focus briefly on the discussion of NATO. And we would like to leave you with the words of our friend, Erwin Logodek, whose podcast on NATO, he's at the Elliott School of International Affairs and is a real expert on the topic of NATO. So we have one candidate stating that he got NATO by threatening to leave NATO, pull the United States out of NATO. He was able to get NATO members to pay into it. He made it sound like an imaginary pot of money, which actually does not exist. Instead, when we refer to the 2% of NATO, it means each country member is supposed to use 2% of their GDP for defense. And by the way, they aren't. We do, but the rest of NATO members typically do not. And they have various reasons they claim for doing this. But it continues to be the case that they're not paying in, so that hasn't been accomplished. They're paying more, but they're all not up to speed yet. And Canada, our neighbor to the north, as I understand it, is the least compliant, not even approaching the 2%. So it's up to you to determine if the claim that they were shaken, you know, and made to do this is real. But there was also a claim by the other candidate that mere diplomacy had restored trust in the United States and the NATO alliance was stronger than ever. Is that really true? Or is it true that Russia invaded Ukraine and it suddenly became apparent to Europe that there was a shortage of defense resources from materiel to funds available for aid for Ukraine? Now, while NATO is bigger now because we've added Sweden and Finland, European countries continue to move to populism. We're watching closely the elections in France right now and the UK. And that may change what NATO looks like. So as you'll notice, neither candidate got it exactly right, but nobody challenged them in these claims. Nor was that necessary, because as national security lawyers, we serve a role of educating on the nuance. So how would you use U.S. laws and policies to bolster both NATO engagement and individual countries' expenditures? So how would you seek to use U.S. laws and policies to bolster both NATO's engagement and their expenditures and the overall strength of the alliance? These are questions you're going to have to answer as national security lawyers over the next decade. And if NATO were to be dissolved at some point from attrition or a lack of participation or a lack of individual countries doing the level of defense spending that is required of member nations, or refinements to Article 5, which is the if one of us is attacked, then we all fight back provision of the Charter. What would you do if NATO were to shift, change, lose efficacy, or disappear altogether? These are actually thoughts that you need to think about as national security lawyers. Discuss with one another and think about what laws treaties, not just NATO, might have an impact on this and what any diplomacy in this direction or other international agreements might look like. So this election season, we're reminding you to keep the keel in the water, your heads level, and your eyes on the law and Constitution of the United States. Thanks so much for listening to NSLT. We would encourage you to share this episode with a friend and to discuss its topics in a thoughtful way with one another. Make sure you hear other people's opinions and arguments and fact check, because it will be important for you to do this as a lawyer in life. It'll make you a better lawyer, as a matter of fact. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is far more diverse, both in race, ethnicity, and thought, than any other country. Thanks for listening. A writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. And my other co-producer is the amazing Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you soon.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.